Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tena, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify this program with my good guests. My guest today is Mike Sajinova, who is the chef owner of Wakahoshi Ramen in Chicago, which opened in November 2023. Mike joined us in episode 280 in November 2022 and shared his fascinating story of how a young man who grew up in Chicago got into Japanese culture, ended up living in Japan, and discovered the profound world of ramen. Among ramen connoisseurs and aficionados, Mike has been known as Ramen Lord on Reddit. He has been generously sharing valuable knowledge and educating whoever wants to learn about ramen so that they don't have to go through the hardship of not finding relevant information to make a good bowl of ramen by themselves. And ramen has become very popular in the US in the last two decades or so, and it would be fair to say ramen has become a part of American food culture. Mike's new ramen shop has been gaining huge attention since its opening, and Wakahoshi Ramen represents the potential of ramen as a global cuisine beyond a Japanese traditional noodle dish. So today, we'll discuss how Mike got into ramen, why he decided to quit his successful job as a market research analyst to open a ramen shop, the challenges he has faced in opening and running a ramen shop in Chicago, the soulful ramen he offers at Wakahoshi Ramen, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Mike Sajinova. Hello, Mike. Welcome back to the show. And last time we spoke on the show, you promised to come back when you opened your ramen shop. So here we are. Congratulations.
Yes, yes. Happy to be back. Thank you for having me again.
So this is exciting. I'm so happy for you that you really successfully opened such a popular ramen shop.
I know. I can't believe it either, frankly. It's quite the adventure so far.
Right. So for listeners who have not listened to the fascinating episode 280, so tell us your background. So where you're from and how did you get into ramen?
So I'm from Oak Park, Illinois, which is a suburb just outside of Chicago, Illinois, and I've lived in the Chicagoland area pretty much my whole life. I got into ramen mostly through getting into Japan and Japanese. I studied Japanese in high school and then majored in it in college. And then in college, I did a study abroad for 1 year in Hokkaido, specifically in Sapporo, Hokkaido, at Hokkaido University, Hokkaido Daigaku. And Sapporo, one of the big foods in Sapporo is miso ramen. And I had loved food and cooking for a long time. In fact, early in high school, I wanted to be a chef. And so I just was very fascinated by local cuisine, started eating it, started really getting into it. I was a poor college student, so ramen was really affordable. And it kind of just became more and more a part of my life, so much so that I was effectively studying it as part of an independent study in college. And when I came back, it was gone. The only way to kind of scratch that itch was to start making it. And that was in 2010. So I've been making ramen then for the last 13 years at a relatively consistent basis. And it just kept growing and growing in popularity until eventually I realized I could make it a big part of my life and not just make it a hobby. And that's kind of how we've gotten to where I am now.
Right. So it's interesting. When I was listening to 280, I really reconfirmed your analytical mindset. The way you speak is so fact-based. And I think you're, I don't know which came first, you became a market research analyst because of your mindset, or you were trained also to be so analytical. But I think the way you acquired your knowledge of ramen without being trained in Japan was really impressive and fascinating. So what do you think of that? Is it related to your background of analytical?
I think it's sort of a chicken or the egg question, in so much that I think I am an analytical person by, I don't know if it's by genetics or by just my upbringing. You know, I grew in a very scientifically rigorous household. My family is all very math centric. You know, my grandfather was a math professor. My brother is an engineer. So we have like kind of a predisposition, I think, to this kind of analytical thinking. And I was raised certainly to appreciate that. But in the same way, I didn't know what I was doing when I was making ramen, and to make sense of it required giving myself guidance and guardrails and consistency elements. And I've always been of the mindset that numbers and data help align to consistency. Anybody who cooks recognizes that this isn't always the case. There is some sort of intangible quality of cooking, right? The feeling, the emotive feeling. But if you don't have any of that, where do you start? And some sort of, you know, objectivity was helpful in terms of starting me off, especially given that I began making ramen with basically no knowledge whatsoever.
Right. So, and you're very, inherently curious person. That's why you studied Japanese from high school, and all those things culminated in ramen shop that you started to work on. Right. So, but you had a very successful career as a market research analyst, and you know, but you decided to quit that job and open a ramen shop. So why did you do that?
I mean, that was not like a sudden random decision, for the record. I think that, you know, I had, as I mentioned, I wanted to pursue cooking as a passion for, you know, before I became a market researcher. But after having dabbled in it, you know, I did kind of an unpaid stagiaire position for a year in a local Italian restaurant and found the work environment very abusive and often difficult. I just felt like a more, you know, traditional work path might be more suitable for me. But I always just felt that itch to go back to cooking and producing food for people professionally. And gradually, as I became more in love with ramen and also noticed that there was an opportunity there, it kind of just reignited that passion for me, if you will. And I started very slowly. I started doing pop-ups in the city of Chicago and other areas, and their popularity further vindicated, I think, that that drive, that there was something here that I didn't, you know, I think opening a restaurant is really tough, frankly. And I cannot imagine how difficult it would be if you didn't have people who were interested in your work, like if you were just somebody giving it a shot, right? So by testing it a little bit and seeing if people were actually interested, that helped kind of give me some confidence to say, okay, this restaurant, if I open it, maybe people will come, maybe they will actually visit. And that's, I think, you know, ultimately the success of the business is predicated on people actually coming to eat the food, right? Like they have to come and visit routinely. So, you know, over a course of 5 or so years, I gradually identified if this could be a business actually. And after like year 3 or 4, it became obvious that like, okay, this is not a fluke. This is not a flop. This is something legitimate that people seem to enjoy. And I certainly enjoy. And so we should be pursuing this more seriously. But it didn't start that way, right? Like it was just a hobby for a long time. It just kind of gradually transformed as, you know, I saw how I enjoyed it and I saw how others enjoyed it.
Do you think people came to your place because of, I don't know, the lack, like in New York City, there are millions of ramen shops, and in Chicago, I don't think as many, but also the quality that you offer is outstanding. So these are the elements, you think, that made your popularity already pre-opening the restaurant?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, I think there's an element of there's a confluence of a lot of different things. I think some of it is, yes, I think we do deliver really high quality ramen. I think I've dedicated a lot of time to learning about this, and I care very deeply about the product we make, and I'm heavily involved in all facets of the production. Even in, you know, in the pop-ups, I was literally making everything, right? So I was super involved and really wanted to deliver something high quality. In the same way, though, I also think there's an element of scarcity and hype that has been gradually building around this. And I think there's also this narrative that is kind of compelling, which is it is a chef-driven ramen restaurant. And chef-driven concepts, I think, are popular. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to open is because I knew I could make it chef-driven. I knew it's like it wasn't just some nameless, faceless place. It was my ramen shop. And if people wanted to learn about ramen from me, this was the place to do it at. So having a little bit of a specificity in terms of who this restaurant represents, you know, who is this restaurant about, that I think is compelling to certain people. It's not just some giant corporation. It's just a guy who loves ramen, right? It's just Mike who loves ramen. He wanted to open a ramen shop. That's very compelling.
Interesting. And also Chicago is a home of Alinea, which is very analytical, scientific, and also creative, super creative minded restaurant. So maybe there's a culture for you already there.
Maybe. I mean, certainly, all the analytical work in the world only helps if the food itself turns out to be delicious, right? So it still has to be good. You know, I can gram and measure and scale and be as precise as I want, but if the recipe's bad, the recipe is still bad. So, you know, a customer comes in and they're curious about, maybe they've heard some things about our ramen, but they still have to like the ramen at the end of the day, right? For all the analysis is just part of a narrative or part of a thing for me to help me establish control and optimization. But it ultimately comes down to how did the customer feel? Did they have a good time? Did they enjoy the food? Right. And no amount of analytics can necessarily perfect that. Right. It's a subjective thing too. So I don't know I think the analytical side of it has helped me establish some stability, but we're still working on it. There are imperfect things that are happening constantly at the shop. I think people just like the food, and that's good because I like the food too. I mean, I eat it all the time, so I certainly hope so.
Yeah, and I think I read an article about in which you said about opening a restaurant, I cannot not do it. That's the comment. So you really pursued, you devoted everything you had into this concept of ramen to create the ramen and maybe to the public to communicate the beauty of it. It's almost like your mission, a life work kind of thing that I felt. So
it definitely feels that way. Yeah.
Right. So, Akohoshi Ramen, which you opened in November 2023 last year, so it has 55 seats and has been one of the hottest new restaurants in Chicago. Right after its opening, it started to get a reputation. So what is the concept of Akohoshi Ramen? And what is the goal that you want to aim?
It's a good question. I think that I answer it by saying what I tell. So we have a pre-shift meeting before service every day. And I always introduce the pre-shift meeting by saying the date. And I say, this is Akohoshi Ramen. We serve ramen and not much else. And I know that sounds kind of tongue-in-cheek, but that is kind of the mission statement, which is I wanted to open a ramen shop that really just served ramen. Like its goal is to serve the best ramen we can. And I don't have anything else on the menu because I don't want to distract from that goal. I felt like very clearly ramen is complicated and difficult. And for us to deliver the ramen I wanted to, we had to be very focused and very specialized. So we only have ramen. We've got like two or three rice sides, but it's basically just because I wanted them and not because they're difficult to put together. The ramen is what the shop is about. And our mission is to deliver the best ramen we can. We only have a handful of ramens right now. We have four that are kind of always on the menu. And then we have a special that rotates each month. And that's really what that ramen is about. Within the context of the shop, there is a big component of education. Like, I love talking about the dish and kind of showcasing it and discussing the components with guests or talking about what the history of the dish. So, you know, as an example, as of this recording, the special this month is something called Muroran curry ramen, which is a very specific style of ramen that emerges from the Muroran town in Hokkaido. It emerges, I want to say, in the 70s. And, you know, who's heard of this style of ramen before? I mean, I hadn't even really heard of it until a couple years ago. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to be able to showcase these local variations. So I always try and bring that into the fold too, right? Like, ramen is a nuanced and complicated dish. And I think that there is a lot of further unpacking that one can have about it in the United States. And Akahoshi is a place to kind of do that in a very physical, concrete way by actually showing the dish, like making the dish in that way, right? There's an educational element within the context of make the best ramen possible, which is make ramen that helps people learn more about ramen in that way.
Right. So I've seen, great American chefs' ramen shops, but yours is almost confirming Japanese tradition, and it's almost like inside out. You scientifically analyze what's in there, and you really try to kind of represent what it is about. So I was very impressed. So why did you name your ramen shop Akahoshi Ramen?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, depending on who you speak to, it could be Akahoshi or Akaboshi. The two characters that make up that term are red, akai no aka, so akai, red, and then hoshi, or it would be boshi in some readings of this word, star. So it's essentially a rough translation of red star. That terminology is used in a couple ways in Hokkaido specifically. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, the flag of Hokkaido has a star, a red star specifically on it, which is used to designate the North Star, because Hokkaido during kind of the Meiji Restoration period is kind of seen as like the northern frontier for the Japanese government. The Japanese government has occupied Hokkaido for a long time at this point, but not really established itself as true owners of the land until that time period. And to be fair, there's some problems with this. There's some serious colonialization problems with this, but I digress. The Red Star represents this kind of new frontier idealism. And to this day, if you walk around Sapporo, the capital of Hokkaido, that prefecture, you will see on some occasions little red stars decorating certain official institutions. The old government building has red stars on it. The clock tower has old red stars on it. Certain buildings on Hokkaido University, the first, which is really the first designated space built by the Japanese government, have red stars on it. So these red stars are kind of symbolic of Sapporo and Hokkaido fundamentally. In the same way, in Chicago, if you look at the city flag has four red six-pointed stars on it. And so I like that this name effectively encapsulated two places that were important to my life and to who I am as a person. Right, I grew up in Chicago, Chicagoland area, so Chicago, and I studied abroad in Hokkaido and learned my love of ramen in Hokkaido. And so this name represents effectively those two concepts being pushed together as Akahoshi.
Right, totally makes sense. Really, like, what do you do exactly represent what the red stars Akahoshi means? So
right,
it's amazing. Yeah, well named. Okay, so, and also, like, you know, the whole culture of Hokkaido used to be, Hokkaido used to be called Gaichi, like outside land. And also, there's Ainu, native.
Right, the indigenous Ainu people.
Right. So there's like any place, like almost any countries have that issue. But I think Ainu cuisine started to be more you get more focused on how to appreciate it, or some culturally we try to preserve it, something like that. So hopefully that cultural awareness we're going to continue and also develop into something right. But anyways, you really observed everything in Hokkaido, and probably way more than average Japanese person, which is exciting because your ramen includes a lot of Sapporo-style ramen, right? So I will discuss it later. So, okay, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into the ramen offered at Takahoshi Ramen, which represents Mike's unique philosophy and very hard work. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Mike Sadinova, who is the chef owner of Akahoshi Ramen in Chicago, which opened in November 2023. So, let's talk about your ramen. So, what do you call the style of ramen you offer at Akahoshi Ramen?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't really know. I mean, we have 4 different ramens on the menu plus the special. I think it depends on kind of which dish you're looking at. You know, the kind of flagship bowl of ramen that we make is called the Akahoshi Miso, and that is heavily inspired by Sapporo-style miso ramen. So it does a couple things that are really quintessential to that region's variation of miso ramen. And to be clear, miso ramen may or may not have been invented in Sapporo in 1955. There's some kind of discussion about where it's invented, but the general consensus is that it kind of emerges from Sapporo in that time period. And it has the following criteria. The first is it uses a wok. That's a little unorthodox for ramen making in general, where most of the time it follows a set procedure of assembly in the bowl itself. In Hokkaido, the wok is very critical to the success of the flavor profile. You get a lot of this kind of, you know, aerialization of fat particles that combust when they hit the flame, and it gives you what they call wok hay, or the kind of breath of the wok. That flavor is really critical and kind of quintessential to the Sapporo style miso ramen. So a wok is essentially mandatory. And so we have a wok at Akahoshi Miso that's only use is to make miso ramen. That's the whole purpose of that one station, is just to make miso ramen. The second component is the noodle. So the inventor of miso ramen, Ajino Sanpei, worked very closely with a noodle manufacturer now known as Nishiyama Seimen during that period to develop a very specific noodle for the dish, one that wouldn't sog out, one that would have its robustness. And that noodle is notably higher in protein, higher sometimes in egg content, which is a little unorthodox, but not atypical, and is also aged at room temperature for a long period of time to develop complex flavor and texture. And so we don't have egg in ours, but we do a number of similar techniques to that style of noodle. It's a curly noodle. It's slightly thicker. You know, I think ours is about 1.6 millimeters right now. It's curly. It's got really dense texture from long periods of aging, and we really try and nail that texture. And the third thing that is kind of classic to, you know, miso ramen is just a little bit of like austere topping with a sizable amount of lard. So lard is a big component of the dish. Depending upon which kind of generation of miso ramen makers you see, the quantities vary considerably. So, you know, Ajino Sanpei, it's a pretty sizable amount. At newer shops like Junen or Sumire, it's an egregious amount, like a half inch thick cap of lard coating the surface. And then at more modern shops, it's maybe less. And so we kind of play with it. For ours, it's about 20 to 30 cc's of lard per bowl. And we're kind of more dialed in into that later stage. But we really want to think about these components. That being said, it's not truly a full Sapporo-style miso ramen for a couple of reasons. One, Sapporo-style miso ramen almost universally uses pork bones in the soup. It's very atypical to use anything besides that or to exclude pork. And our soup is a chicken soup. We have no pork in that soup, actually, except for the lard, which, you know, lard is delicious. I just couldn't get rid of it. But the soup is chicken only at our shop, and that is a little atypical. The second thing that is a little different is our miso blend is a little different. So in Hokkaido, it's pretty common to blend variants of white and red miso, and we certainly do that. But we also incorporate hacho miso, which is a type of miso that only uses soybean in the mix. Most miso is a combination of soybeans that are mashed and something called koji. And I'm mostly speaking to listeners here. I assume, Akiko, you know this already. But, you know, koji is this inoculated rice that's been inoculated with a fungus that gives miso its flavor. Hacho miso, that fungus is inoculated on the soybean itself. And so the production is much different and the flavor is very different substantially. So we incorporate hacho just because I like the flavor, but that is super rare. I don't think I've ever even seen a Sapporo shop that uses hacho. And that might just be my ignorance. I don't know. I don't want to, there's so many ramen shops in Sapporo alone. There's over 1,000 or something. But it's pretty rare to use that in the blend. But we do because we like it. So fundamentally speaking, at a high level, I think stylistically, we have a lot of the similar components. We're using a wok. We're using the miso in the wok. We're hitting it. We have bean sprouts, moyashi, very classic Japanese vegetable in miso ramen. The toppings are austere. We use a blend of misos. Lots of similar concepts, but also variances in concept. Right? There's just inherent differences. And some of those are just choices that I made as I was developing the recipe over the last decade or so. So I don't know what it is. It's Sapporo style ramen, but also not. I don't know. It's kind of become its own thing.
Right. But I have to say that, you know, the Sapporo, I mean, for listeners who listened to episode 280, Mike explained that even within Hokkaido, which is the northern part of Japan, and it's very cold. Mike explained different variations within Hokkaido, and Sapporo is the capital of Hokkaido, and they have a very distinctive style. And then, you know, hacho miso is from Nagoya area mainly. So it's kind of like interesting and very thoughtful idea to add miso, because I think hacho miso tend to be darker color and more
super
flavor
dark
and umami, and, you know, so enhance that deliciousness. And also I think using chicken and stock, I think it make it more cleaner, lighter, and people want to keep coming back. Instead of once a week, you can come back and twice a week kind of thing. That's my opinion.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the soup we use is definitely lighter in terms of its viscosity and definitely in terms of its fat content, right? It's a very clear chicken soup. So that's true. But it's still it's a decently rich bowl. I mean, still got a good amount of lard on it comparatively, you know?
Right. So that's why you probably need the balance of chicken as well in compared to like
just like
quintessential.
Right, exactly.
Right. So, and you have other types. Do you want to talk about other types of ramen?
Yeah. So in Hokkaido, if you go to a miso ramen shop, they almost always also have a shoyu ramen on the menu. In fact, they usually have a shoyu and a shio, which they call like the three tastes, right? So I thought it was pretty important that we also have a shoyu on the menu. So we have a shoyu, but it's got kind of your quintessential Japanese flavors. It's kind of got some Tokyo-inspired notes to it. It's heavier on the niboshi. Those are those dried sardines that are very common in ramen cooking. It uses the same chicken soup base, but it doesn't have any miso. It's more classic in terms of its feel. But we use a Sapporo-style noodle in it. So it's got sort of nods to that alternative that you would find at a Sapporo style ramen shop, right? It's, you would find this kind of shoyu at a Sapporo style ramen shop potentially. So that's the other main soup ramen on the menu. And then we have two soupless ramens, which is more of a Mike likes soupless ramen, so he put it on the menu type situation. The first is something called Shirunashi Tantan Men or Soupless Tantan Men. Tantan Men is a loosely inspired by Dan Dan noodle dish. So it's got ground sesame and, you know, kind of vinegar and chili oil and spices. And we use a different noodle, a more flat, wide noodle for that. That's better like being coated in sauce, akin to like a pasta, if you will. And then we have, you know, and it's just like kind of tasty. We top it with this ground pork mixture called, you know, soboro, which is very common, and more of those spices and a little bit of bok choy for texture and color. And it's kind of this rich sesame, flavorful, spicy dish that it's kind of interesting because, you know, if you say Tantan Men in Japan, most of the time people think, at least my understanding for a long time was that you're referring to Tantan Men, the ramen, which was a soup dish, but it's derived from Dan Dan noodles, which are not a soup dish. And so there's kind of this interesting food pathway in Japan about how Tantan Men turned into a soup dish and then reverted later as newer shops open as like Shirunashi Tantan Men or soupless Tantan Men. And so we've kind of taken that latter portion and kind of developed it and changed it for what we like in the ramen. So that dish exists on the menu, and I don't think that one's ever going away. It's super good. I eat it a lot. And then I just like all my ramen. And then the fourth ramen initially was kind of like, I felt like we were going to have a lot of waste product in terms of making chashu, and I needed a way to use some of that waste product. So rather than throwing out end pieces of chashu, you know, it made sense to develop a dish that could use those components in a delicious way. And so we have an abura soba basically on the menu. It's a very loose version of abura soba. You know, abura soba is this style of ramen that kind of emerges in the 70s in Tokyo. It's kind of near universities, arguably Waseda University is where this thing initially becomes popular. It's basically a soupless ramen. You just take the tare and the oil and you toss the noodles in it, and then you add lots of textured toppings to it. And so we kind of up that and make it a little more, you know, distinct by adding like fried shallot and fried garlic for texture, and the chashu pieces are cubed up and kind of molten and succulent. And then we have some alliums on there for freshness and brightness. And it's kind of this fun alternate of ramen. It's like a stirring ramen. It's soupless. It's kind of garlicky. It's kind of punchy. It's got some MSG in it. It's just kind of no frills, but really, really tasty. And that was the four. For a while, those were the only dishes we had on the menu, at least for the first month. We didn't have any specials or anything else. It was just four ramens. This year, we've introduced a special each month that kind of encapsulates either regional style or just a sort of esoteric type of ramen that people haven't really heard of. You know, I just wanted to have another on the menu that was different and was sort of ephemeral and would go away after a while, right? Rather than just constantly changing the menu, having something that would shift. So each month we plan on introducing a different one, typically a regional variant for this year. And then maybe next year we'll see kind of what that special will be. But showcasing ramen in its various ways is an important component to me.
Right. Well, that's going to keep you excited as well, because it's
right.
Very creative.
And the team, yeah.
Right. And also, you know, these are five items, but it's very hard to perfect everything. And on top of it, you decided to make your own ramen noodles,
right,
which is very challenging. And even in Japan, it's very difficult. And many shops opt out not to make their own. They just order noodles. But you do make your own noodles. So
correct.
Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Initially, I wasn't planning on doing it. I have a very good relationship with Sun Noodle, and I really love them, and their product is fantastic. And so initially, I felt like it might just make sense to buy noodles. But as I got down the path of opening this shop, I quickly realized that I enjoyed the flexibility of making my own noodle and the ability to change a recipe or update a recipe or make a noodle to whatever specification I wanted. And an example of this is, you know, last month we had something called Akayu Spicy Miso Ramen, which is another type of miso that emerges in the late 50s in Yamagata Prefecture. And it uses a very distinct noodle that is thick and then hand massaged. If I wanted to buy a noodle like this, I would have to special order it and it would be cost prohibitively expensive. And so I just liked the idea of being like, well, I know what this noodle is supposed to be like. I can figure out a way to make it and we can make it the way that's supposed to be for this dish. And we can just have what we want and not worry about sourcing it or finding another person to make it. I didn't feel like, I felt like it allowed me a lot of creative freedom. And I just really felt like if I wanted to tell everybody that we made everything in the restaurant, that also had to mean that we made the noodle. So I'm lucky in that I have been making noodles for a long time prior to opening this ramen shop, just certainly not at this scale, but I have some foundational knowledge on noodle making. But I'll agree with you that noodle making is brutally difficult. And I understand why many shops, especially in Japan, don't. Unlike in Japan, in America, you've got maybe two or three manufacturers to choose from, and the type of noodles that you might be able to select are very limited. In Japan, you've got dozens and dozens of manufacturers per city, and they'll often do a custom noodle for you or have a variety of SKUs for you based on kind of your specific needs, so you really do get a more tailored experience. And that allows a shop that is operating at an extremely high level to still do that even if they're buying the noodle. For me, I felt like I wanted that level of execution, but there wasn't, you know, like the best noodle manufacturer son, they give me, there's four options to pick from. And I just wanted more flexibility. That was ultimately where the decision came down to.
Right.
I think that that has resulted in us to expand our creativity a lot. You know, last month we did three different noodles. Next, we're doing two now because the curry that we have on the menu now is from Hokkaido. So it uses a noodle extremely similar to a Sapporo style noodle. But next month we have a different dish and that one will need its own separate noodle. And I just like that I can do that. I can just change my mind. I can just say, yeah, it's going to be this noodle next month. And that's fine. That works for me.
Right.
It's a lot of work, but I think the result is a really strong product and one that we can say is distinctly ours and no one else's.
Well, I heard that it takes 5 hours a day to produce like 300 servings.
Yeah, give or take. And right now I'm the only one doing it. So every noodle that leaves the restaurant has been made by me currently.
Well, I'm sure your arms are like going to the gym. Like, 5 hours a day.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I don't know.
Right. Well, but I think that really makes sense that you choose to make noodles by yourself. Otherwise, you know, your curiosity and pursuing the consistency by data. Otherwise, you open the restaurant, but you probably get bored quickly, according to who you are. And you have to keep pursuing. It's like a Japanese, martial arts kind of mindset. There's no end. You have to pursue. So, and I heard the machine was expensive. It was especially
it was from Japan. Yeah, it was expensive. yes.
Right. So, but to keep you going, it was like almost including a shipment. It's like $45,000 or something.
40. Yep. Yeah, it's it's a Yamato Richmond one. It was imported from Japan. It took almost a year from start to finish to get the noodle machine. I purchased it initially thinking I was going to open in a different space and then that deal fell through. But by the time I had already submitted, you know, the first half of payments, I was like, okay, I got to get this machine. I received the machine in 2022 and I didn't have anywhere else to put it. So I just put it in my apartment for like
over a year. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's your best friend now. You used to live with
it. It really was. It's kind of vacant where it used to be. Like, I'm looking at where it used to be right now, and it's a little bizarre.
But, yeah, I totally understand. Like, it's almost like buying a new car or something, right? Because you really get attached to it. You want to do a great job because of the machine as well. So
right.
It's motivating. Right. So, do you have any popular items out of your 4+ special where people tend to prefer certain things or equally well selling?
Yeah. So, I mean, the reality is that the American palate gravitates towards certain flavors. they really like tonkotsu as an example. Now, we don't sell tonkotsu, but they really like certain elements of tonkotsu. Notably, its richness, its depth of flavor, its viscosity. And so in the same way, many people who have been to my shop are still coming for the first time because it's often quite difficult to get into. You know, we have a handful of repeat customers, but many people just cannot get the reservation fast enough. So most people are still coming for the first time. Mm-hmm. I'd say on any given day, 80% of customers coming into the shop have never been to the shop before. And so they tend to order at least one Akahoshi miso. It's the namesake of the shop. It's rich, it's comforting, it's super hot. It's got a lot of those characteristic qualities that I think people are looking for in the American palate of ramen. So that one sells the best, far and away. I'd say over half of my sales are that one bowl. From there, things are a little more even keeled. You know, the special, the shoyu, the tantanmen, those sell around the same. It really just depends on what the special is. And then the abura soba, I think it's kind of our sleeper hit, which like those who order it love it, but a lot of people don't really understand what it is yet. We have to be better about educating people and telling them what it is. It's definitely... You know, it still sells, but it's not nearly as popular, of course, as the miso. The miso is just the clear front runner on our menu.
That makes sense. Akahoshi.
So, yeah, it's got the name in it. I mean, I'm not surprised, right? If I just called it miso ramen, it might not sell as well. But I also just think Americans like miso ramen. Like they like tonkotsu, and then next up is miso ramen. Those are the two. They don't like shoyu or shio as much, right? Which is, you know, kind of inversely different from... Japan, I'd like to say. I mean, my understanding at least was that in Japan, shoyu ramen is the most typical style that people kind of grow up eating.
That's my case.
Yeah. Like, I don't know where you grew up, but unless you grew up in like Hakata, you probably were eating some variant of shoyu ramen, right? Like that's kind of the de facto standard style. But in America, it's tonkotsu. Tonkotsu is the de facto standard style. And so... just kind of accept that there are some cultural difference between those two countries in terms of how this dish is consumed.
Interesting. So, I mean, you just opened your place, but what did you face as challenges since getting ready to open and also running for the last two full months? And what did you learn from them?
Oh, that's a tough question. There's been a lot of challenges. I mean, I've never opened a restaurant before, so everything was an extremely rigorous learning experience very quickly. There's a lot of things that an outsider probably doesn't recognize about a restaurant that are very challenging. Probably the biggest is, you know, everyone says staffing, and I think, you know, when someone says staffing is a challenge, that can mean a lot of different things. For us, it's just... we're a small restaurant comparatively. So when someone gets sick or when someone, I don't know, God forbid, gets in a car accident, which did happen to one of my staff, like it causes a lot of strain on the rest of the team. And I had not figured out a good plan of action for how to deal with that. So often it meant I was just taking the burden on myself because I don't want to burden my staff. My staff are really important to me and they make the restaurant work. So figuring out ways to alleviate the concerns of the staff was challenging for me in ways that I did not anticipate. How could you anticipate when, you know, someone has to call off because they have to go to a funeral, right? Or when someone's wife is having problems and needs to go to the hospital. How can you anticipate these things? They're not anticipatable. These are just the purpose of the human experience, right? People live their lives and bad things happen to them and they need to deal with them. And as an owner, I'm constantly aware of needing to be flexible enough to allow them to need to live their lives. These are human beings who are helping me live my dream. I have to help them with their lives too. So I didn't expect that. When I staffed the restaurant, I just assumed everybody would be full-time and everything would be great. And the reality is that people have other things going on and sometimes it requires being flexible. So I'm learning that process of like how to develop the redundancy, the ability for people to step in, the ability for people to cover, the ability to maintain production even when people have other things that they need to attend to, and being accommodating to those things, which I've tried to be as much as possible, but ideally accommodate them without me having to be the one who falls on the sword. Do you know what I mean? Like finding a better, more sustainable path of accommodation is a big part of it. Because it's not like an office job, right? Like in my office job, if you got sick, you could work from home, right? If you got sick or you just take a day off and it didn't really matter because the level of productivity didn't diminish so much because you're working in a company of like 100, 200, 300 people or whatever. So one or two people being sick didn't impact, you know, production or work as much. And frankly, just being ultra candid, I think often corporations operate with a level of assumed inefficiency that a smaller business does not have the luxury of dealing with, right? There's all these, like, sometimes people just mess around in corporate jobs, like, and there's not a lot of room to mess around at a small ramen shop. We have to be very disciplined and be very, you know, hands-on throughout the course of our day. So staffing has been a challenge, but not in a way that has been upsetting, just in terms of like, I didn't know. I just genuinely didn't know, having never opened a restaurant. But I think we're doing the best that we can.
Right. So the picture, it sounds like it's not technical or anything like open a place to serve the best food. It's more like your picture is much bigger. That involves a huge ocean and you have to surf around. And every day, and you don't know which wave comes next. And this concerns.
I've been lucky in so much that my team has been really awesome. Like everybody who works at Akahoshi is really dedicated, really motivated, really inspired by what we're trying to do. And so I think that that's a rare place for a lot of restaurants who often struggle to find talent who's going to stay motivated and be interested. I'm very lucky in that regard. But the challenges instead are just managing it and making sure that everybody's okay and making sure that everything is good. And that is a challenge. That is a fundamental challenge of being an owner that I did not anticipate. But it's a different challenge, I think, than a lot of restaurants have, frankly. I think they deal with much more, you know, kind of more entry level problems, like so-and-so just decided not to come to work anymore. I haven't had that problem, right? Like, everybody shows up. if they're sick, they let me know, right? Like everybody's very communicative. But it's still a challenge. It's still a challenge, no question.
Right. Interesting. Like, you know, when I go to a restaurant, when I open the door, I instantly feel that energy, positive or negative. And then whenever the restaurant is very popular, there's good energy. I want to be a part of it, the kind of thing. So it sounds like you have that energy in your place. That's why one of the reasons you are so popular. But on the other hand, what is the biggest joy of running your own ramen shop?
I don't know. It's kind of a lot of things. I love all of it, which is sort of crazy to say because often I'm working like 14 to 16 hours a day. I think I just like the fact that it's mine, which is crazy to say. I don't know. But like, it's very surreal for me to think about how much work I've put into thinking about ramen and then have it become something concrete and real in the world that a stranger who's never spoken to me or never talked to me can experience just as much as someone who has been to the restaurant 10 times and is a big fan of Akahoshi and potentially of Ramen Lord, right? Like those people can both have the same experience. And that is very surreal and very wonderful in a lot of ways. It's also wonderful that I've been able to bring together this group of people who kind of share this common goal. Like I was worried that I wouldn't be able to. And it's awesome that, you know, despite having to train a lot of people, we, I think, are delivering a really high quality product. I mean, I know there are always ways to improve it. I can see the cracks and the little imperfections in the way we do things. But you know, I also am really proud of the work that we put out. Every day I get to look at this ramen and be like, oh my God, like some of these bowls of ramen are like what I've dreamed of for the last 13 years. And it's happening right now. So, and it wasn't because some investor told me it needed to be that way, or it wasn't because I had to like get my butt kicked by a really mean chef. Like we just figured out how to do it. And I think customers can sense that. I mean, I think my customers generally enjoy themselves and that's very rewarding too, right? Like, we make a bowl of ramen that I think a lot of people enjoy. That ultimately is why I got into the business.
Right. So you self-funded the whole thing yourself?
Pretty much. Yeah. I got some help from my folks, but for the most part, I poured my life savings into this restaurant.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah, well, I'm so glad you're already very successful, as far as I heard.
Well, it's still early. You know, things can change, but so far things are going well. Yeah, I think things have been very, very good so far.
Right. And the landscape of ramen in America changed dramatically since you started making ramen 13 years ago. So how do you see the changes in ramen culture in Chicago and in America overall? And also, what do you think will happen in the American ramen culture?
Yeah, that's such a difficult question. I think about this a lot, really. I think that certainly in the last 4 to 5 years, you started seeing an emergence of these, I guess, Kodawari style shops, or a handful of really dedicated professionals who just genuinely loved ramen and wanted to make ramen shops because they love ramen. And I feel like there are only a handful of those in the United States right now, but every year or two, there's another couple people who say, you know what, I'm gonna throw my hat in the ring, or I want to get involved in this. And the more of us that kind of stick together and become communal about our ramen craft, the better I think ramen is poised to be in the United States. I think for a long time in the United States, ramen was kind of a niche food, and then it exploded, but was inundated by pre-manufactured components, pre-manufactured tares, pre-manufactured soup bases, pre-manufactured oils or toppings even, because of this influx of Japanese chains who recognized this opportunity to make money. And you're starting to see a little bit of a pushback away from that, I think, in some capacity. Certainly a number of the chains that opened in Chicago have since closed their doors, because I think people have started to wise up to kind of what those foods are. And they're looking for something a little more compelling and more distinct in their ramen. They don't just want the same ramen that everybody else is selling. It's not perfect yet, but these handful of shops that are making everything in-house, these handful of shops that are kind of doing a dish that is their own or distinctly their style, they're becoming more prevalent. It's slow, but it's happening. And I think when that happens, you're going to see more interesting ramen develop, you know. And that was a recent phenomenon. You know, it hasn't been that way for a long time. And I mean, I think that's going to continue to happen.
Right. So I think we are seeing this kind of dichotomy of mass market style ramen, but we started to realize you can really geek out and it's worth doing it. Ramen is the casual image is image, but it's so deep. It's like a sushi, right? The supermarket sushi, or you can pay $500 per person sushi because you can go into there as deep as you want, and you can pursue the quality, and you can be probably pretty philosophical and spiritual about what you use. Because there's a history in there, and you can always improve, because that kind of tradition is supposed to be always kind of redeveloped. And what you're doing, I think, is very interesting. And I'm sure Hokkaido ramen, if there's a god of Hokkaido ramen, he's thanking you.
I hope, honestly. That would be very flattering. Yes.
Yeah, that would be confirming, redefining, or going back to what it was, that looking at the roots, you're doing it very objectively, analytically, which we educate everybody, including Japanese people. And I really admire what you're doing. So what are your plans and dreams?
Yeah, it's funny. People ask that even when I was in the process of opening the shop, like, what are your long-term goals? And it's like, let me open the shop first and find and get back to you. So now the shop is open. And the shop is operating. And I think my goals are still fairly short term, because the shop is still pretty new and fresh. I think that the goals are so much that, one, I want to get this place to a place of stability and sustainability in terms of the workflow and in terms of people's lives at the shop. I feel like right now, that's pretty close for everybody except me. For me, I could see myself becoming very burnt out if I had to keep working 16 hours a day indefinitely. And so part of that is building a team of support for when I do get sick, or when I do need to take a day off, or when something bad happens in my life, right? Like, things are going to happen to me just as they happen to everyone else. And I need to make sure that our team can support not just each other, but me as well. So that's kind of the next phase, is to build a level of autonomy in the staff and to make them feel empowered and capable enough to take over the reins when I can't be there. And I think we're close, but we're not there yet. I think you give us another 3-4 months and we'll be more comfortable with that. Certainly I will be more comfortable with it, which is important as I'm the boss. That's the short-term goal. The long-term goal, I don't really know yet. You know, I would love for this restaurant to exist for a long time. I think that's really the long-term goal. I want this to be a restaurant that is seen as, you know, an important part of Chicago's landscape because it has existed for a while and because it says something about this dish, you know, in a meaningful way. That's just going to take time. You can't become a stalwart of a dining scene overnight. You have to build credibility and you have to build a team of people who care and you have to build, you know, the right recognition. And that's just going to take the work of doing this dish every day and doing it the best that you can every day. And that's what we try to do. So I'm optimistic, but that goal is pretty foundational. It's just like, I know it sounds corny, but it's like just exist. I think a lot of people assume that I'm going to open another shop or open, you know, a chain or try and do some licensing deal. I have not humored any of those ideas. I would just like to run this shop and see how the shop goes. I would like the shop to be successful for a long period of time. If we can do that, I'll be pretty happy.
Right. And as far as I know, you're very solid and very sensible about what you do. But once you do, it's very stable. So I think you're going to make it very stable. But also, you probably come up with something in the process of running a restaurant. So yeah, please do keep me posted. And I'm sure you're going to come back and talk about your progress or next plans or anything. So please do
so. Of course. Of course.
So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
So the two places are probably my personal Instagram page, which is ramen_lord, or the Instagram page of the restaurant. That is just Akahoshi Ramen, one word. You can also go to our website, akahoshiramen.com, where you can find the menu. You can find ways to book reservations. You can find information about the restaurant, information about me. And you can see my email if you ever want to ask any questions, which is info@akahoshiramen.com.
Awesome. All right. So thank you so much for joining us today, Mike. And hopefully you get some sleep sometimes.
Thank you.
Right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@theheritageradionetwork.org or kikukatema.com. Japanneeds' weekly program is always available at theheritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. My engineer is Liam Warner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week.
Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.